Good evening. My name is Alex Veto. I am a Libertarian candidate for House District 61. I am a founding member of the local Libertarian Party here. I have been a delegate to the state party. And looking to get myself out there, you know, as much as I can. I'm a full-time student, so it has been hard juggling that and the campaign, but I am doing what I can here. Going to be graduating this semester. We'll be, well-equipped to go into this. I think that about covers the important stuff. Won't take up any more time. Hand over to Jim here.
Hi, I'm Jim Hamilton, representative, the current incumbent representative in House District 61. For those of you who don't know, House District 61 starts at Rouse, so you're sitting in our district, and goes east to the Park County line. During the session, I sat on the Tax Committee, Transportation, and Agriculture Committees. Tax really does seem to be where I'm naturally suited, and it's an interest that I have, so hopefully I would, if reelected, will get a chance to be on the Tax Committee again. First came to Bozeman in 1978, and like a lot of you, I've seen Bozeman change a tremendous amount, but I still love this place. Mm-hmm. All it takes is going someplace else for a week to come back and go, you know, this has changed a lot, but this is a pretty darn nice place. So I'd like to make sure that Montana and Bozeman continues to grow in that manner. Just recently retired as a financial advisor after 35 years, and that helps give me a little bit of step up, I guess you might call it, in the tax committee. Have a variety of other interests. I think the biggest interest that I have coming up during the interim, I serve on the Revenue and Transportation Interim Committee, and that's the committee that determines what the revenue projection that we spend at the next session will be. And so we're about to do that on November 19th, and I would encourage you to come and testify in front of that committee. Even though it doesn't sound like the kind of thing you might be interested in testifying on, because we need to hear from the public more about the seriousness of that. And as you know from the cuts that we experienced this last year, it's a very serious matter. So thank you for coming. Thanks to the League and the Library for hosting this. It's great to be here.
Thank you, Sally. My name is Zach Brown. I am the incumbent in House District 63. I'm running for my third term. I first came to Bozeman in 1990 when my mother delivered me at a midwifery here, and also have seen this community change a lot. I graduated from Bozeman High in 2009 and went to college at the University of Montana, spent 1 year on the East Coast working, and realized how badly I needed to get home and be near my family, my brother and sister and their families, my five nieces and nephews, and my parents all still live in this community. Some of you may know my folks from Old Main Gallery and Framing, which they owned for about 30 years downtown and just sold in the last couple of years. So I come from a perspective of somebody who loved my experience in the Bozeman Public Schools and really benefited from that. I benefited from a public education in the university system. I got to know this community through the lens of two small business owners, my folks, and now my brother, who owns a stonemasonry company, and my brother-in-law, who's a real estate agent in town. I care deeply about this place, and in my third term, I just turned 28, so when I first ran, I was 23. So I'm the second youngest legislator. I can't really talk about that too much now with Joey really whipping my butt in that regard. But I work really hard to represent the university, which is part of our district. I've been a champion for student debt reform, funding for higher education, big supporter of the 6 mil levy, and generally feel that investments in public education are really fundamental to what the legislature ought to be all about. Finally, I'm really a bipartisan voice for my district, and literally sit at the back of the Democrats with all the Republicans, so work really hard to represent everyone in my district. Thank you.
Well, everyone, my name is Joey Chester. I'm the Republican candidate for House District 63, which, as Zach said, is a university district in Southwest Bozeman. Zach, is it weird being a UM graduate representing MSU? No, I'm kidding. I grew up in Northwest Montana in a small town of Columbia Falls outside Glacier National Park. And when I was growing up, I really had a passion to serve. I was really involved in my church and my community. I've done many mission trips across the country serving underprivileged communities. And in my own time in the Flathead, I held many valley-wide volunteer things to benefit underserved groups. And so that's really important to me. I've always felt that I had a servant's heart. And so when it came time to go to college, I knew I didn't want to leave Montana. I love Montana, I love our values, and I wanted to stay and help contribute to that. So I chose Montana State University here in Bozeman. And when I got here, I was a little bit involved in politics. I've always had a passion for politics, but I had no idea that in the spring I'd be running for office. So my passion to serve has now taken me to this position, and I'm really honored to do that. And when people ask me what my driving force is, it's really, as a college student, the opportunity to get to represent college students in the legislature is super exciting to me. And so I'm honored to do this. I really want to serve. And I look forward to sharing more with you.
Thanks so much for coming out tonight. This is an incredibly important election. My name is Chris Pope. I'm running for House District 65, which starts over here at Hawthorne School and goes all the way out close to Gooch Hill, all the way from Durston up to the interstate. So it's the broad cross-section of North Bozeman. I'm running because I think state government, which is caught up in incredibly divisive politics, is getting close to the point where it might be losing some of its mission and its ability to work for a bright future for all of us. I have served in the second term at Four House District 65. I've served a first term for House District 65, back in 2014, where I voted for Medicaid expansion, campaign finance reform, extending opportunities for students with disabilities, and for clean energy initiatives, which I care very deeply about. I bring a background of having been downtown for 15 years with my wife, Maddie, who's in the audience, and I started the Great Rocky Mountain Toy Company, and for 15 years we ran that business. It was very gratifying, and I got to know the merchants downtown, and together we decided to put together a plan to rebuild and polish downtown. For 12 years, I was the parking commission. We built a parking garage. And you'll recall, we built the streets, and we brightened it up. And we did it without it being partisan. And we did it without the rancor. And we put our heads down. We got the work done. We raised a ton of money. And today, we can see the result. That's what I want to bring to Helena. And I will talk about that more this evening. But again, thanks so much for coming.
Hi, my name is Dr. Jane Gillette, and I'm a professional door knocker. Just kidding. I feel like I am. No, I'm a scientist, a small business owner. I direct a nonprofit, and I'm a mother and an activist. I have two areas of expertise within science. One is called translational science, so that's how you get scientific findings into practice. So I just completed a book chapter on evidence-informed policymaking, so that's how you get scientific evidence into laws and into policy. My other area of expertise is what's called health disparities research, so it's a subset of epidemiology, so why some populations get sick and some don't. I have a strong science background. I'm actually a spokesperson for the American Dental Association on evidence-based dentistry, and also a couple years back received the very first award by the American Association of Dental Research, the Evidence-Based Practice Award. Besides science, healthcare is a strong area of expertise for me. I serve on a Montana nonprofit health insurance board, the Montana Health Co-op, and I've done that for, about 4 years now. I also do consulting work with community health centers with a group out of Boston, working on quality improvement and smart business strategies and community clinics. I'm a lifelong learner, so I completed my doctorate at University of Washington, and I just completed my MPH this term from the University of Montana. I've also studied executive leadership at Kellogg School of Management, Wharton School of Business, and studied value-based healthcare at Harvard within the Institute of Strategy and Competitiveness. Besides science, healthcare, and business, I'm very passionate about disadvantaged populations, and I've worked with nearly every disadvantaged population you can think of, from Alaska Natives to Montana and American Indians. I run a nonprofit where we provide free preventive dental services to disadvantaged children across the state. Last year, we saw 11,000 children in schools across Montana. And lastly, I'm the last year's recipient of the HRDC Future Generations Award, and I'm very much looking forward to engaging more with you throughout the night.
We have asked the candidates to prepare 2 minutes on the following question. What is your plan for addressing the lack of mental health services in Montana? And so the candidates have had this question to prepare. Who wants to start?
Sure. First off, I want to say mental health is a very important issue to me. I personally have been very affected by someone close to me with mental health issues. But the fact of the matter is, the Democrats and our Democrat governor in the state have overpromised and underdelivered with Medicaid expansion. Because of Medicaid expansion, providers in the state cannot afford to survive. They're basically being paid what I like to call a slave labor to provide mental health services. And this is a big problem because we have graduates from the Montana University system who are very qualified to provide, but they don't want to because they can't make a living, so they leave our state. And that is a problem. So if you don't know, Medicaid now pays for 1 out of every 4 Montanans, and 26,000 people are using Medicaid to access mental health in the state. I'm a conservative, and I believe that if government passes a law to provide a service, then they should provide that service and pay a fair market wage. But that's not happening. So what I'd like to see happen is see that expansion expire and use those funds and actually appropriate them to mental health services in the state of Montana. Don't get me wrong. I support mental health, and I hope I can champion that in the legislature. Thank you.
Montana spends approximately $250 million annually on state mental health programs, about $240 per person per year, well above our neighboring states. That serves about 42,000 Montanans who receive mental health care services, nearly double the national average. Access to mental health care in Montana is unacceptably low, well below our neighboring states, and that was before the 2017 legislative session, when these programs, already critically underfunded, received another blow from severe budget cuts that closed clinics in places like Dillon, Libby, and Livingston. So what to do? I will fight to reinstate the mental health service budget cuts from 2017. Note that the majority party made some of those cuts permanent, which will make the healing and the restitution of that budget decidedly more difficult. Second, I'll join colleagues to focus on prevention and accessibility. We need to incentivize wellness. For example, MSU's Center for Mental Health Research and Recovery is exploring an internet-based interactive therapy program called Thrive to identify and address depression in rural communities. I think that program has tremendous opportunity and at a much lower cost. Finally, we should aggressively move to community and home-based care that appears to offer much greater benefits over the centralized institutional care that we are currently served with. I would ask the community healthcare partners in Bozeman to be a principal voice in that discussion. Our mental health care services are expensive and substandard. Let's work to be more efficient and more effective and make Montana that special place that takes extra good care of its most vulnerable populations. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Quickly, I guess the premise of my comments are that mental health drives addiction. So when we have an addiction crisis in this country, be it opioids and heroin. And in fact, on Monday, I was in Billings talking to providers on a bipartisan panel of Republicans and Democrats, serving in the legislature, talking about how the state needs to deal with this opioid crisis. This last session, I worked with Attorney General Fox, who's a Republican, to put forward legislation that would have put limits on opioid prescriptions. On Monday, we were talking about how we can find funding to backfill the cuts that the majority party made last session to mental health services. I would say that along those lines, there is a lot of bipartisan attention in Congress to the opioid issue. We ought to be trying to figure out how to capitalize on that as a state. We need to make a plan as a state on how to put our put ourselves in front of the federal funding opportunities through SAMHSA and other programs so that we can backfill some of those services. Another idea that I am working with Attorney General Fox on, borrowing from a couple of other states who have tried this, is thinking about a pill, a penny for a pill tax on opioid manufacturers to fund treatment courts. That would be the idea. So if you're not familiar, Gallatin County has a veterans treatment court here that is funded totally through your property tax dollars. It's a really powerful way to help people deal with addiction and recidivism. So those are a couple ideas. And finally, I have to address my opponent's comments about Medicaid expansion. Cutting out the rug from underneath 90,000 Montanans would be a really irresponsible way to deal with this issue. It would only deepen the problem. We have to find ways to continue that program, which brings in federal funds and otherwise backfill services. Thank you.
Jim.
Thank you. I believe there's probably every one of us in this room has been affected by a mental health issue. Certainly know I have. I'd be very surprised if there isn't somebody, if what I've said isn't true. During the last session, the majority basically eviscerated mental health services in our state. And because of that, I decided that I was going to spend some time understanding the issue. It doesn't come in front of one of the committees that I go to or that I sit on, but I decided it was a very important thing that I needed to know more about. So I've spent a lot of time attending the local advisory council meetings, which bring together all of the mental health professionals in the community. And from that has sprung, I think, a pretty straightforward plan, not necessarily find a pot of gold for the money that we need, but a process to get there. And that process would be, number one, we need to sit down with people across the aisle, it needs to be on both sides, and decide what's our priority. We really are not going to get to fund everything that might be important to us, so we need to decide how important is this to us. And once we decide how important it is, then I think we need to have in-depth discussions with the providers. Providers are very well aware there's not an endless supply of money. They've made that very clear at the local advisory council meetings. But they also have a multiplicity of ideas about how to deliver services more efficiently than are currently being delivered and help the populations that are near and dear to them. The third and last thing I would say is that there's a big concern about how much money we're spending institutionally versus community-based programs. And that's another thing we need to look at to see if we can't stretch our dollars further.
All right, well, I agree with a lot of what's been said here. I agree with Jim that this is a multi-partisan issue. To that end, I think there are some good liberal solutions, good conservative solutions. I agree with Joey, for instance, that competition, free markets are the primary way that we ought to be solving this. I do agree with Chris also that decentralizing will help, specifically increasing access by way of teleconferencing, allowing such an infrastructure there would be helpful. However, I think this also is ultimately a cultural issue. There is still a lot of stigma attached to mental illness. What we need to be doing is willing to have an open, honest conversation about that, increasing outreach programs, allowing people to come forward without judgment so they can seek the treatment they need. And also going to the issue of addiction, I would be for fully decriminalizing drug use, no victim, no crime. That would allow people to come forward, seek the treatment that they need without fear of prosecution. So yeah, I think we need a little from column A, a little from column B, and some solutions that have not yet here been proposed.
Mental health is important not just for the individual, but for society and for economic prosperity as well. And in order to ensure a thriving economy and community, Montana needs to make it a priority to make available quality and appropriate care. regardless of anybody's income. So my plan for addressing mental health within Montana would really be to work on the support of the three pillars. And in my mind, the first pillar is actually coverage and payment, which we touched on, making sure that it's adequate. And that would include not just within Medicaid, but also private plans as well. The second pillar is ensuring that we have a sufficient and diverse mental health workforce. So that means ensuring that our licensure and regulation not just protect the public, but they're not too onerous for individuals either, so that they can work within their scope of practice adequately. Increasing loan repayment options, I think, is important for this providers, as well as making sure that there's enough training sites available, particularly for clinical psychologists. The third pillar is to ensure that there's a sufficient availability of appropriate and different care intensities, like inpatient care, intermediate care, like we talked about, community-based care, group homes, but also crisis intervention and jail diversion. In all three of these pillars, I would really strongly advocate for evidence-informed policymaking. So I would strongly support having both meaningful and timely and, of course, accurate data available on the effectiveness and the return of investment of each program. For example, since 2009, the state's been funding grants to counties in the number of $2 million each year, and yet there's no data that comes back from those programs on their effectiveness or return on investment, so I would strongly advocate for data to make sensible decisions.
Thank you. Now some rapid-fire questions. I'm going to start with Jane. We're just going to go down the line. What's the last book you've read?
I'll answer the most memorable book I recently read, because I just completed my master's in public health, so maybe all of them aren't that memorable. But Half the Sky, I recommend that everybody read that book. It's about social justice and women and some of the issues that go on internationally regarding some deep, difficult things that women go through.
Okay. Chris?
I remember the author's name, Fear, by the Watergate.
Bernstein? Is it Bernstein? Okay. Joey?
12 Rules for Life by Dr. Jordan Peterson. Excellent book. Recommend it.
Zach?
All the King's Men by Robert Penn Warren. I'm in the middle of it. It's about a really big personality, slightly dictator-oriented governor. Sound familiar?
Jim?
Ooh, you know, I'm terrible at this because I can never remember book titles, but it's the it was a Pulitzer Prize winner, The Light We Can't See.
All the Light We Cannot See.
All the Light We Cannot See.
I only remember the name, the authors and the name of the book. I can't remember the book.
Okay.
Alexander?
Politics in the New Hard Times. It's a series of essays that look at the recession of 2007-2008 through a political rather than economic lens.
Okay. And Alex, what figure in history do you most admire?
Oh, that is a tough one.
And you don't have to say why, just who it is.
Oh, man, that is a tall order. Most of
it. Should I come back to you?
You might need to come back to me.
Okay, Jim?
Churchill.
Teddy Roosevelt.
Ronald Reagan.
Gandhi.
You're going to laugh. Bill Nye the Science Guy.
Bill Nye the Science Guy. Okay. Alex?
John Hosmer.
Okay. And dogs or cats? Zach?
Dogs.
Joey?
Dogs.
Chris?
Cats.
Jane?
Dogs, for sure.
Jim?
Dogs.
Alex?
Dogs.
Clearly, we have a dog group here. Dog candidates, remember that. All right, now we're going to open it up to questions. And what I would ask you to do is to stand and speak very loudly and ask a question. Please do not give a speech. If you give a speech, I'm going to be ugly and stop you. So don't. Yeah, each person, you can direct your question to any of the candidates, but everybody gets a chance to answer it. And let's do a minute to answer, okay? Yes?
Probably more towards Chris and Jane. Given the recent IPCC report on climate change, and Montana's dependence on the outdoor industry and for the common good of everybody on this earth. Do you have an idea of what we can do at the state level to drastically reduce our carbon emissions?
What are your ideas to reduce our carbon emission at the state level?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thanks for the question, and I'm actually very involved in that subject. Working with Northwestern Energy on a work group to plan for the future, and I'm on an advisory board, so I'm not telling Northwestern Energy what to do. You know, the carbon issues and climate change are very real, and we're seeing them in terms of our water and our agriculture here in the state. I am in 10, 30 seconds. Okay, so in 1985, I was working with the photovoltaics industry, the solar electric industry, and it's just been a lifelong mission to move away from carbon fuels, which I think we can do in our lifetime. It's going to take the next 15 or 20 years to do the full transition. So I'm working with Northwestern to work on solar and wind and energy storage, modernizing the grid, going to demand-side technologies, and I have to stop because I'm not. But there's a lot more.
Yeah. I had to get my notes out here, but yeah, I don't know if you're familiar with Project Drawdown, but Project Drawdown actually has a list of the 100 most effective strategies for reducing greenhouse gases. And I'm sure you know that, you know, because of Montana's low population size and compared to like India and China, we're probably small players in the world, but nevertheless, we should do our due diligence. Some of the most effective strategies, of course, are reducing like refrigeration and air conditioning, things like that. So I would say starting with smart buildings, efficient buildings. Of course, investing in renewable energy, so onshore wind turbines, I think, is actually number three on their list. So I would recommend that as well. Of course, just going to basic things like a plant-based diet. I think that there's lots of fun things that we could do with respect to that. As a community, just making it easier for us to bicycle or use electric cars, and that's it.
Others who want to speak?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. I would just say that one, in terms of the renewables and integration of more renewables into the marketplace, we've been arguing in the legislature and with the utility companies for at least the entirety of my two sessions about net metering and how to set a fair price to allow consumers to generate their own electricity and get compensated for that back onto the grid. Last session, the Republican chairman of the Energy Committee handed me a bill that had been drafted and asked me to carry it. And it ended up being the only legislation that's passed in the last 6 or 8 years regarding net metering, and it initiated a study so that we could really get to the bottom of the true cost, a fair cost, so that renewables can be competitive. And the other thing I just would quickly mention is adaptation is the key to climate change in Montana, because as Jane mentioned, our emissions are a tiny blip on the global radar, but we have to adapt. Our farmers and ranchers and fishermen and natural resources depend on it.
Well, actually a cool story. For 5 years when I was growing up, I lived off the grid with solar panels. So I've had some experience with that type of energy. And in the legislature, if there's renewable energy that makes sense in the marketplace, I'll be for it. That's really what it comes down to me. And the fact is, Montanans by nature are conservationists, and I believe we're doing a good job in that. Thank you.
I'll be quick. I do think there is a free market solution to that. I think what we need to be doing is rolling back market-distorting subsidies to established players in the game that keep out emerging competitors, notably those in the green energy market. So if we can roll back that, I think we will naturally, as a result, have more green energy available.
I think when I think about where the state can be of most use, I think it's in really being a role model. Moving from a fossil fuel-based approach to a more renewable-based approach really just needs to become the accepted and normal thing to do. And one of the best ways to do that, I think, is to be the role model. And that's, I think, one place the state can really make a difference. This is not a popular idea, but I would look at a carbon tax. We may have to adapt it. We may have to adjust it so it does what we want to, but I think it's worth considering. Snow and water is economically a really big deal in this state, and we need to preserve that. Lastly, upgrade the grid and just keep moving towards renewables as we can.
Another question.
With the rising cost of childcare in our state, I don't know how many of you have children, but for working families, how are you going to address that in the upcoming years?
How are you going to address the rising cost of childcare? Who wants to start?
All right. You know, this is a very big issue, and I'm not sure there's a great solution, but I'll give you a couple of ideas that I would throw out. One is, children benefit from getting a good preschool education, pre-kindergarten education, and I think we should devote resources in public education to that. That would help a little bit on child care issues. Second thing is, I think that we need to find some ways to sort of offset parental costs there that may not be a direct offset, but perhaps that is use of a medical savings account, something that I had proposed last time and actually got passed. And perhaps there's some other child credits that we could put on the tax return that would help in those areas. But my top solution would be devoting more assets, more money to public education and in the pre-kindergarten area.
Yeah, that is a big issue to tackle, as Jim was saying. I do think that at least part of it, looking at early child care, health care costs, that comes down to addressing, issues related to the pay gap, rather the pink tax, as it were. Women's health care, especially those related to child care, are higher, and that is a result of, again, market distortions and lingering prejudices that need to be addressed. I think that's, again, part of the solution. There is a lot more to it than that, but I do think that will help.
This just brought back a memory from the Doors earlier this summer, knocking in my district. I talked to a woman, and just a little bit of background. When I was in college, I was student body president at the University of Montana, and we had a large child care service. It was the largest child care provider in Missoula County, actually. And so it was a huge part of our budget. Students basically taxed ourselves to pay for it. And so I got some familiarity that year because we were struggling with the state STARS certification program. Cost a whole lot of money to comply. I certainly believe that child care facilities and businesses need to be regulated because we put a lot of trust in those providers to take care of our kids and keep them safe. But in some respects, and this goes back to my conversation with a woman on the Doors, these businesses are being overregulated, and the ability to comply and deal with the state agencies that deal with that is really putting some folks out of business and also pushing some of our child care services onto the sort of quote-unquote black market. So we need to deal with that, and I remember having a long conversation earlier this summer with a woman about that. We need to expand on the governor's pre-K program that was initially funded through some block grants this last session. And finally, we can work on providing better maternity and paternity leave legal frameworks. We worked on that a little bit last session. It didn't get very far, but certainly I think we should have strong paternity and maternity leave options for parents in the state.
So I'm actually going to the Child Care Connections donor luncheon tomorrow. So I don't know if you know what Child Care Connections is, but I would say supporting more programs like that would be very important. I've worked with Head Start for, a decade now, I guess. And it's odd, but sometimes the classes are difficult to fill, which is really remarkable. But we've had decreased enrollment, for sure. But I understand your concerns. I'd echo what Zach said. That's exactly what I was going to say about regulations, of course. And, of course, supporting the governor's preschool development work that he's done. That's been fantastic. I've seen that across the state in preschools. One thing that I think that I don't see, and this goes back to a memory at the door too, a couple of them, but what we could do more of would be employer-based childcare. So I talked to several moms who had their child either at Bozeman High School. There was a spot available there, and it was great because she could come visit her child, you know, in between classes and at lunch. Also, I talked to a gal who worked, I'm blanking on the hospital, but I think she came from Billings. She had been a medical practitioner from Billings, and they had in their medical facility had a child care unit too. So I think, you know, bringing your children closer to you and a little bit of employer subsidized child care could be helpful.
Well, I'm a big fan of pre-K, and I think it's an issue that the state in the last few legislative sessions has been trying to address and has pretty much whiffed at the ball. It's very clear, I think Montana is one of eight states in the U.S. right now that hasn't invested in pre-K in a substantive way. The key years are from three to six. And in some circles, you'll hear that it's more important to educate a child from 3 to 6 years of age than from 10th, 11th, and 12th grades. That there's more developmental benefit at that front end. So I'm a big fan of investing in our kids. A child that's at risk that has early education is 75% less likely to drop out of school, 60% more likely to become a teen parent, and generally the benefits just are across the board. So I also would support parental leave. Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm a student, so I'm super supportive of education and child care. So I believe that if it makes sense for the state in our budget, in a place where we don't have to raise taxes, because I will not vote for tax increases, then we can work on our pre-K program because that education is important. But I also believe that there is partially a free market solution here where, kind of like Zach and Dr. Gillette said, too much burdensome regulations on childcare, that's going to raise costs. And so if I can look at that and there's a way that we can get rid of some regulations to make childcare more affordable, I'm all for it. And, you know, I'm a student, so I'm always trying to learn and come up with new solutions, and I'm going to be very open to that in the legislature. Thank you.
Hey. Yes.
If a bill was introduced to stop the water treatment facilities from adding fluoride to our drinking water, how would you vote and why?
Did everybody hear the question? Okay, fluoride. Who wants to speak first?
I'll make this short. So like I said, I just graduated with my master's in public health. I'm a dentist. I would vote no. And that's because the scientific consensus is in favor of fluoride preventing tooth decay in children and in adults. Tooth decay in children is the single most chronic childhood disease. It's more common than obesity, asthma. I would vote against that.
I'm going to have to semi-punt on this because I think it's a very contentious issue. The city of Bozeman, I think recently in the past year or two, has made some determination about fluoride in our waters and voted for fluoride in the water after extensive consultation. So that would be my starting point. And then, I think, we really need the data to know exactly what the issues are, which you haven't presented, and I fairly, because you don't have the time to, but I think that's something that would be required in order to have a really decent conversation about that. Thank you.
Yeah, on this one, if this ever came across my desk in the legislature, I would have to look at the data behind it and then make a decision, yes or no. But I do think it brings up an interesting point. We should always be looking at the types of things that we're putting in our body, whether it's through water or for food. So I'm always going to be open to discussing these issues, but I need to see data on something before I can make a decision on it.
I just want to echo what Jane said.
Jane was very articulate about it, wasn't she? I'd like to echo it also, but I want to add one thing, and that is I was on the Ag Committee, and the Ag Committee dealt with raw milk. Apparently, the Ag Committee deals with raw milk every single session. And so we'll probably deal with it again here shortly. And that was a very contentious and long, drawn-out process to try to figure out which set of data was really correct.
And ultimately, I voted against legalizing raw milk, I guess is the best way to say it. And so what I would do in this situation is follow the same process I did there, which is to really look at both sides of this, question both sides, and look at the data and make a decision from there. I don't have a preconceived notion.
All right, I would vote no on this. I have examined the data. The scientific consensus is that fluoride out of the waters at the levels that it is not harmful to the human body. There are a small number of dissenting studies, but on further examination, they all have systemic flaws in them, usually related to sampling size issues. There was one that came out of China, actually, that used maybe a dozen people in it. Yeah, can't derive much from that. So no, the scientific consensus is clear. There is no reason to vote against that. Vote for. I would. Sorry. Fluoride is okay. That's what I'm trying to say.
Thank you. Yes.
What are your ideas for improving the revenue projection and the budget for the next biennium, since the current budget has caused a great amount of cuts that are very harmful to Montana?
Will you say the front end of that first, again?
How would you improve revenue projection for the next biennium, and that the revenue projection goes into how would you improve or make the budget more effective for the next biennium?
You want 2 minutes for this? Big question. Who wants to speak first to it? 2 minutes.
As I mentioned at the start, I am on the Revenue and Transportation Interim Committee, and that's where the revenue projection comes from to begin with. That revenue projection is then handed to the legislature, and they, over the course of the following 4 months, either chooses to revise it up or down. What I think we need to do here to avoid the problem that we ran into last time is have a subcommittee that looks at the revenue estimate, does their due diligence along the way. Last time, we had one discussion on the revenue estimate, and it was when the majority party decided to raise it $100 million, which then led to quite a series of budget cuts. We need a revenue subcommittee. I think that subcommittee needs to have public members on it, and we need to evaluate that on an every week or every 2 week basis and take a very stringent due diligence on that so that we get it right. The truth is that the budget is not that, the two estimates we live with, the governor's estimate and the LFD estimate, Legislative Fiscal Division, are really not that far apart. We might be talking a couple of percentage points apart, but because of the size of our budget, that becomes a lot of money, and we're running at such a narrow reserve that it becomes a problem. The budget as a whole, kind of moving away from the revenue estimate, the appropriations process, I think, is once again what I talked about originally with mental health services, which is I think we need to sit down with the other side and say, look, what are we willing to fund, and let's fund it fully. And if we're not willing to fund it fully, then let's leave it off the list until we can figure out how to do so. And I think that will make a more sensible budget, which will then not create these situations where we raise the estimate, come in below estimate, cut services, have to put reestablish the services. It just is a terrible system.
So it turns out, you know, we had a special session last fall, and it turns out that special session was not necessary. Revenue estimates ended up actually coming in much greater than the governor had predicted, and so the governor calling a special session was completely unnecessary. And we need to remember that those budget cuts that were made during special session came at the recommendation of the governor. So for some reason, it's been placed all on Republicans, that the budget cuts are Republicans' fault, and that's simply not the case. We should have waited until we knew more of the revenues from President Trump's tax cut plan before calling a special session. So I think going in to the next however many years of budgeting, we need to wait until we have those exact numbers before making any drastic cuts or for calling another special session. I believe that revenues are going to be really good. They look really good right now, and I think that trend is going to continue. Thank you.
Structurally, I guess I would say that I serve on the tax committee, House Tax Committee with Jim also. Structurally, our tax system is antiquated. It's a system that is designed to capture revenue and fund services based on a 1960s and 1970s economy where you have really tangible products and services, and you can tax coal and oil and gas and trees, whereas today's economy is a service economy. So this is an issue that every state is facing. How do you tax companies like Oracle, which is one of the biggest economic drivers in this county? How do you capture revenue and fund services based on the service that and the product that they provide? Right now, our system is not. The one issue that every state deals with, how do you tax Amazon? How do you capture revenue that funds basic services from a huge corporation like that? That has intangible services. So these are issues that we have to dedicate bipartisan attention to. I would say from a tax code point of view, my ideal world would be a fair income tax structure that is progressive and that it is graduated towards asking those that earn the most to pay more and those that earn the least to pay less. Income tax structure in Montana is one of the only state tax codes that taxes people below the poverty line, on income below the poverty line. So the 2003 legislature under Republican leadership and Republican governor made income tax cuts for the most wealthy. And part of our revenue struggles today stem from long-term systemic structural changes that were made at that time, and they're finally catching up to us. So now we're having trouble funding basic services, mental health care services, wages for our direct care providers. So I think there's a lot of fundamental issues in that question.
Thank you.
Actually, I'm not sure that there's a ton left to add because Jim said it really, really well. The only thing I would add to Jim's comments is the reports that came out regarding the budget this past session were very opaque. You couldn't even see what was being cut. It would just say this service, but you had no idea what was bundled into there. So I think having some standardized and approved reporting so you can actually know what you're voting on and what's being cut would be important. And then also what Zach said about new revenue sources, of course, we just don't have as much coal and timber, and so finding new revenue sources is very important. We've become disproportionately reliant, of course, on property and income taxes to fund what we need. And you can see how acute that is in Bozeman, particularly, where people are just, you know, crying out for relief from property taxes. And that disproportionately, of course, impacts the poor. I had recently one little lady that she couldn't stay in her house anymore. She owned her house, but she couldn't afford the property taxes. So she had to move to Three Forks. But those kind of inequities we certainly can't let exist.
I don't have a lot to add except to say that on my first term in office, we were told, and I think the data is, that the legislative services department up at in Helena, and they're professional, nonpartisan staff, and that historically they've been within a couple percentage points. Last session was a one-off, we hope. We're not, you know, there were some abnormalities about how the taxes were coming in on, and the timing of that, where towards the end of the fiscal year, we started catching up on some of what we saw were deficits. So it was an odd year, and hopefully we'll see, get back to more of a predictable place, because I think, it's not a partisan issue in theory that we pin down the numbers so that we can figure out how to best serve Montanans. I would also echo this interest in diversifying our sources of public income. You know, we also have pockets of corporate giveaways. I've tried to get a bill through the legislature to eliminate a tax holiday for the oil and gas industries. It's about a $30 million number, and it's just outrageous. I mean, these are, you know, Fortune 500 companies. and we're giving, you know, that kind of money away. It's just an outrage. So there are places where we can fine-tune and get back to our blocking and tackling. You know, we need to work for the Montanans to maximize their dollars and their hard work. And I think there's a lot of things we can do. So I'm looking to the future with some optimism. Thanks.
I do agree in part with Zach and Chris on that. I would be in favor of a greatly simplified income tax. Where I part ways, though, is that I believe it should be a flat tax. One of the big issues is, as has been alluded to here, the patchwork nature of our tax code, you know, one that allows for exploitation, loopholes, and that does go back to the issue of corporate subsidies, which I'll get to in a second. But the tax code should be simplified, predictable, so we can more accurately predict revenue and make a budget that matches that. And as for the issue of corporations like Amazon, you know, we see them going to various locales, bidding based on who will give them the biggest tax breaks. And, you know, I say no. You know, we shouldn't be giving them special treatment on that front. There's no reason that they should be paying less than, you know, you and me, like as a proportion of income. They shouldn't be getting special treatment. So, yeah, I would say, and the tax loopholes, and the subsidies, the tax holidays, we should be treating everybody the same, and that should be reflected by income.
So for those of us here in Bozeman, we understand that we're experiencing rapid growth, but that's not the case for most of the other people in our state and the people that you're going to sit alongside. And so how would you handle addressing our issues here of absorbing all of the growth while also having people you work with that are having the exact opposite problem?
So how do you deal with the growth towns versus the shrinking towns? Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. Okay. We're making statewide decisions.
We in Bozeman are very misunderstood, by the way. Thanks for the question. So it's going to be an interesting conversation because it's a complicated set of scenarios here where, for the start, our town is misunderstood in the state. Everybody thinks that Bozeman lives with a silver spoon in its mouth. We've got everything figured out, you know, the Los Angeles thing. What they don't understand is that careful what you wish for. Our successes for the past 20 years, and I tell people routinely, look, we just pulled ourselves up by our bootstraps. We're very fortunate to have a lovely environment. We have a lovely, you know, school, MSU. We have health care and whatnot, but this was all built with hard work. Bozeman folks decided about 30 years ago to put their heads down and figure some stuff out, and we're lucky. We're fortunate. But we have whole set of new issues that for me is incredibly sort of concerning in terms of our quality of life. So on the one hand, we need to be compassionate across, you know, to what Haver and Tudot's concerns are in their communities. But frankly, the degree to which we are pressed for transportation, affordable housing probably is the biggest piece. And it's affordable housing on many levels. It's workforce housing, and it's housing for low-income folks. Those are two different sets of issues. Anyway, long and short, we, in my opinion, need to caucus with Billings and Helena and Missoula and so forth. We do have for the first time, a lobbyist that has been hired by the city of Bozeman to help carry some of the water. But there needs to be an initiative and there needs to be some specific goals, and then we need to go fix that, those issues. Thanks. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. I guess my first thought is just to say that a fundamental part of how this community needs to deal with growth is by investing in foundational infrastructure. And we are doing that totally on the backs at the moment of property taxpayers. The state and the legislature has come up short basically since 2013 in terms of our ability to fund infrastructure. We have a system at the moment where we try and basically patchwork fund infrastructure. We ask developers to kind of pay a little bit through impact fees. And then we put up subdivisions in between, in the triangle in between Bozeman and Four Corners, and come back in 10 years and there's problems, right? And so future generations are going to have to pay for poorly implemented and executed growth. We need to get on top of that, and the role that the legislature needs to pay is funding comprehensive infrastructure reform funding packages. Finally, I'd say I've worked with on water issues quite a lot in the legislature. I'm the vice chairman of the Water Policy Interim Committee. Water in particular in the Gallatin is really the key to how we grow as a community. And I think it's worth saying that part of how we really deal with the smart growth future here in the Gallatin, in my opinion, is empowering our farmers and ranchers who own the water to really have control of that future as much as possible. They provide open space, their infrastructure, their irrigation infrastructure provides ecosystem services and groundwater recharge for all of us. So as much as possible, if we can let our farmers and ranchers in this valley hold the keys through a variety of tools, through water policy and conservation easements, that's better for everyone. Finally, I'd just say I really have worked hard on rural economic development, both in my day job and in the legislature. And one thing I've done specifically is create a program that would provide student debt relief for young farmers and ranchers going home.
This is a difficult line to walk, because the reality is I'm a Bozeman representative, yet I do represent the entire state as well. And so to balance those two things and try to figure out where the win-win situation is a very difficult issue. But I am a Bozeman representative to begin with. One of the things that I proposed last time was a venture capital tax credit to make venture capital available in Montana, more available, because we were right at the bottom in terms of how much venture capital was available in the country. The reason that I propose that is if you look at the kinds of jobs that venture capital funds, they are higher paying all the way across the scale. So no matter what your education level, no matter what the job skills that you have, you get paid more in those kind of advanced industries, as they call them. What I'm hoping would happen from that is that we have the opportunity to not to some place, and Bozeman's, Missoula is another place, Billings to a lesser degree, sort of form the core of those kinds of advanced industry jobs. But what you begin to find is once the core is started, those jobs spread out around the state. In fact, in my presentation, I remember drawing in a discussion about there's somebody out in Miles City, there's another business in Malta, there was another one in Lewistown. There are places like that where people want to go there and live, they like the place, and if we can make it easier for them to do business there, that'll help. Part of making it easier is build the hub from which you can spread out.
I am wary of any measure to regulate growth. I mean, this just goes to individual preferences. People want to live where they want to live, and I don't think the government ought to be attempting to engineer them going one way or the other. That said, the state of Montana should not be neglecting any of its communities. I do think it is important to implement policies that would allow for the expansion of internet services into more rural areas, like better service. To tap into growing online markets for those communities where they might not otherwise have access to those sorts of jobs. I think it's also important to look at zoning regulations to allow for the ownership of more affordable housing. Right now, our zoning laws are kind of a mess. It tends to favor more expensive residences that are not available to the public at large, and that is something I think we need to be working on.
Yeah, I mean, I would have to echo what Jim said in the sense that, I mean, you're voted by your district here in Bozeman, so you're obligated to listen first and foremost, at least in my mind, to the people that elected you, that you represent. So I'm sure it is a difficult balance as someone who travels to all the tiny towns of Montana, like Winnet and Trigo, look that one up on the map. I can tell you, yeah, Trigo. I can tell you that they do have very different issues than what we have, although you're first obligated in my mind to be responsible to your voters back home. I think that there's lots of local initiatives that we can do. I don't know if you've seen any of the materials that come out from the Rocky Mountain Economic Development District. They have a really nice report that is probably one of the best that I've seen, that looks at everything from how we educate our students, you know, where we invest in education, to zoning laws. I mean, it's a very comprehensive plan, to attracting innovative businesses to Bozeman. So I think we need to start looking at some of those local options. Speaking of local options, I'm very much in favor of local control. So I think any time that we can give local control to Bozeman, it kind of gets around that issue of how we might be sometimes in conflict with other objectives that people have within the state.
So kind of like what everyone else said, we are elected to serve our district. So first and foremost, I'm going to listen to what my constituents tell me in House District 63. And the number one issue that I've gotten on the doors is property taxes. The growth in Bozeman has caused folks not to be able to afford to live in their homes because of property taxes. There are especially elderly people on the doors who tell me that they're going to move out to Manhattan or Three Forks because they can't afford to live in Bozeman anymore. And that's a problem. And so I would like to see a real hard discussion in the legislature in 2019 about some sort of property tax relief. And with that, folks are keeping more money in their pockets that they can put into the free market and help with the growth and support the growth. I always believe that any money that we can keep is better. And so in also talking about growth, we have talked about business, jobs. And to encourage more business and jobs, we need to make sure that we're reducing as many burdensome regulations as possible on businesses throughout the state. And so these two issues are not just specific for Bozeman. Those two things would help Montana as a whole and help the whole state grow. But also, like Jane said, a lot of this comes down to local control. I'm a huge fan of small government and local control. And so I think our county commissioners have a big role to play in this as well. And I would like to see us working with them and with other large cities across Montana.
Yeah, I would like to ask all of the candidates where you stand on the tobacco tax and Medicaid expansion.
Where do you stand on tobacco tax and Medicaid expansion, which is tied up with the legislative referendum?
I-185,
yeah.
Well, with regards to expanding Medicare, I mean, if you're going to do it, that is, I think, a method by which pretty much every politician can get behind. I do, however, question the sustainability of that in the long run, given that we would be funding programs to decrease tobacco usage off of the taxes we're collecting from tobacco. So I think we do need to take a harder look at the sustainability of that in the long run. We don't want the rug pulled out from under us if we come to rely on Medicaid funding through a revenue source that is going to dry up.
I think this is two separate questions. One is Medicaid expansion. Medicaid expansion has been a big, big financial boon for the state of Montana. Economic impact is about $350 million. I see various numbers, but it's a big number. That money has flowed into Montana from that plan. It's critical for keeping rural access available in our hospitals. That doesn't affect Bozeman quite so much, but it sure affects Livingston and Columbus and Big Timber and any place else that has a clinic that's a small town. So I think that's an important element. We have close to 100,000 people on insurance now that were not on insurance previously, but they were being paid for, and they were being paid for by the increase in medical costs that you were paying. So there are lots of good reasons to have Medicaid expansion. The method by which we pay for it, I would prefer that we are able to pay for it with the tobacco tax, but if that fails, I still think that the Medicaid expansion is worth putting up as a very high priority for our population's health. You know, the concern that Alex had about what we're paying for a program where we will have a declining source of revenue, well, the tobacco tax revenue right now is over $50 million. The amount that would go to Medicare is half, less than half, actually.
of what we would get from the tobacco tax, we'd have to have a massive reduction in tobacco usage, which we've never seen before in a tax increase, to run out of money there. There are a whole lot more other pieces that need to be talked about on the revenue side for this, because there's a lot of misinformation going on out there, particularly by big tobacco. But I'm out of time.
So I'd just say, I'd echo Jim's comments about Medicaid expansion. It's been really successful for the state as a whole economically. I was honored to be part of the 2015 legislature that passed that into law. By the way, that bill was carried by a Republican, so it was very much a bipartisan bill, a compromise bill, and it was a good deal for working Montanans. The population of folks that did not have insurance before that have it now, those are people that have to deal with less economic insecurity in their daily lives now. Folks that were living on the margins who now don't have to worry about bankruptcy from lack of medical coverage, health insurance coverage, that's a big deal for working folks. So that's number one. I support Medicaid expansion. I think even if this ballot initiative fails, there, I hope, and we'll fight like hell to make sure that there's a working majority of legislators to renew that program. And I hope, I have a great faith that there will not be a will on behalf of the legislature to pull out the rug underneath those 90 to 100,000 Montanans that now have some basic security in their lives and access to health care that didn't have it before. As for the tobacco tax, candidly, I'm on the record as not being a supporter of the tobacco tax simply because it's regressive. It impacts low-income folks the most in terms of a proportion of their income. So I think it presents an interesting question for the voters. That's been what I've told people who asked me about it. I'm conflicted on it. It is interesting in the sense that all of the voters of Montana get to work through a complicated, multifaceted issue, which the legislature does on a variety of things. So you get a little flavor of what it's like to be in our shoes. But either way, regardless of 185, I think that we need to renew the Medicaid expansion program to provide economic security for working class Montanans.
No. I-185 is not a good thing. For one, I'm not a fan of taxes, as you've heard me say many times tonight. But also, the truth about I-185 is that tax is not going to completely pay for the Medicaid expansion like the supporters are claiming that it will. And the issue with that is someone is going to have to pick up that bill. And that's either going to have to be small businesses in our state, or that's going to have to be you and I. And that's not good. That's going to be less money in our pockets paying for something that we shouldn't be. And as for Medicaid expansion, as I've said before, when I was talking about mental health, I believe that some of those funds could be better used, appropriated in other areas. And so I do not believe I would support a continued Medicaid expansion in the legislature. Thank you.
Last week, Governor Bullock was in our town to explain the economics of Medicaid and 185, and unfortunately, I didn't bring all my sheets of paper with me. It's something we can all Google, but be aware that the two tobacco companies have put $12.5 million into the state of Montana to tell us exactly what was just said, that somehow, you know, the tobacco tax increase is not going to cover the cost of Medicaid if we go forward on 185, and that the reality is that 185 will fully fund Medicaid. So I'll say it again. I-185 will fully fund Medicaid as we have it. There's a 90% Fed fund contribution share to this. It's a very large number. It's close to $200 million a year. If we didn't have Medicaid and those Fed funds go away, it'll actually cost the state of Montana something like $36 million in additional funds, outside of the fact that 100,000 people will lose their insurance. It's a very clear, bright line. You know, stay with 185 and let us go to Helena and vote for Medicaid extension. I was very proud, as the most important vote in 2015, to have voted for the expansion of Medicaid. So here we are. I also want to mention that $350 million of our taxpayer funds go to cover costs of tobacco-related disease in the state of Montana, $350 million annually. I can't even put that number in my head. So the long and short is we have huge issues around addiction. There's huge issues for young folks and smoking. And we need to address this, and the first step is I-185 and the passage of the extension of Medicaid. Thank you.
Yeah, I would agree with Jim. These are really two separate topics. One, the first topic is this good public health policy? And then the second is, should we continue to fund Medicaid? So I'll address the first one, public health policy. As a public health practitioner and someone who serves on a health insurance board, I can assure you that this is good public health policy. This is just one of the pieces in a toolkit of how you reduce tobacco use in young adults and kids. Everything from clean indoor acts, you know, that you can't smoke on an airplane. Do you remember when you could smoke on an airplane? Yeah, that laws like that, that you can't smoke inside. This is just one of the tools that you have in your toolkit to reduce tobacco. And the healthcare, the cost to healthcare are great, not just for those who smoke, but to all of us in this room. It drives up the cost of healthcare like you can't even imagine. Then there's the question of, do we continue to fund Medicaid? And I would say the answer to that is yes, in my mind. Do we need to make improvements? Absolutely, we need to make improvements. One of the fundamental things that's broken in our entire healthcare system, not just Medicaid, but that we pay for widgets, we pay for things. So how many knee surgeries do you do? How many images do you get done? We pay for widgets. And because we have this fee-for-service model where we pay for widgets, we, no surprise, get a lot of unnecessary care. And it's estimated that, gosh, probably close to 30% of care that you receive is unnecessary care. And only probably about 8% of the care that you received is based on high levels of scientific evidence. So could we make improvements in the care that's delivered, not just in our Medicaid populations, for all of us? Absolutely. If we start paying for value, so pay for health outcomes instead of widgets, we could see tremendous improvements.
Question.
I'm a retired military veteran, and I would like to see, I've served over 24 years. Your comments about exempting military pensions from state income tax. Exempting military pensions from state income tax. Okay. Your thoughts on that?
Are you in favor of exempting? Say it again. Sorry. It's a long
day. Exempting my military pensions.
Military pensions from state income tax.
Being taxed by the state.
Okay. And I'm going to ask you, you get 1 minute max, okay? Who wants to go first?
First of all, sir, thank you for your service. This is a question on the tax committee that was put in front of us. I'll jump in front of the bullet here because I spent a lot of time looking into this issue. There are some folks that have spent a lot of time pushing for that in the legislature. One accountant from Deer Lodge comes to mind that I've spent a lot of time on the phone with. I guess the unfortunate answer is that we came up to a no, essentially, that it is a it would be pretty devastating to our state service or state's ability to provide services if we started to exempt retirement income. The retired age folks in this state require a lot of services in terms of end-of-life services, health care, etc. And so once you start going down that road where you exempt people, it's really tricky. But certainly, I really appreciate the question. Thank you for your service.
I'll jump in here. I actually came out of a military family when I was a kid growing up. So the question when it came in front of the tax committee was a difficult one to deal with. The question in my mind, and not to, this is no reflection on level of service and the importance of the service in the military, but what do we replace it with? We were in a very tight budget last session. If we had passed that bill, we would have had an even bigger problem with cuts because we had nothing to replace it with. And I think there was also a little bit of concern that if we do this for military folks, then do we do that for teachers? And do we do it for, what other groups do we do it for in terms of fairness? So not to diminish the importance of the service, but I think it was just something we couldn't afford to do.
I'd also like to say thank you for your service. My father served in the Marine Corps, Vietnam, so I have come from that. I would not be for exempting that, and again, I think that just goes to a matter of simplifying the tax code, a matter of fairness, that income should be across the board taxed the same for everyone.
First off, I'd also like to say thank you for your service. I certainly think that this is something that we should look at, but I think the current representatives have brought up very valid points that if we have a large shortfall in our budget because we're exempting people, that could really be a big problem. And so if there's ways that we can reduce spending in our government and then allow for some tax breaks across the board, I think that would be great. I'm always looking for ways for everyone in this room to keep more money in their pockets.
I'm going to echo what's been said. I thank you for your service and others in the room. I'm sure we have others. I know my father-in-law served in the Navy. I want to thank everyone for their service who's had that experience. I think as when it comes to taxation and policy, we have to look at the whole and then maybe consider a thought like that, but not as a one-off, as part of the whole. So we don't get sidelined and all of a sudden into the woods. But thanks for the question.
Hi. Again, thank you for your service. I also served in the Air Force, and I still take care of soldiers in the Army National Guard, Fort Harrison. And I would echo what the rest of the group said, and then I would also say that there's a small part of me that feels a little conflicted when I think about tax holidays of gas companies, and I think, well, that's just not just and equitable, is it? And so I don't know that excluding the pension is the right answer, but I can tell you that it also doesn't feel right when I think about things like that, too. So I think it's probably a complicated topic, but I'd like to learn more about it. Thank you for asking the question.
And thank you all for your questions. They were great questions tonight. Now we're going to have 2 minutes closing from each of the candidates to tell you why you should vote for them. Who wants to be first?
Again, my name is Joey Chester, the Republican candidate for House District 63. Look, the fact of the matter is I have a passion to serve, and I really want to take that to our legislature. And I have a few main goals to tackle there. And one of those is fiscal responsibility. I want to make sure that we're reducing burdensome regulations in our government that stunts business and economic growth in the state. I always want to look at ways to reduce taxes so that you guys can keep more money in your pocket, because I believe that is the true way to bolster our economy. In addition to this, I'm a champion for students. I am so fortunate to be a student at Montana State University with over 16,000 others, and the opportunity to represent them in our legislature is exciting. And when I'm there, I want to look for ways to get rid of our one-size-fits-all education system and allow for more school choice, trade programs into school, and real-world career training, so that students know that it's not just college that's the only option, that they can go out, they can get a job, and contribute to the economy of Montana and not have to leave our state. In addition to this, I'm going to fight for your public land access. I will protect, preserve, and expand your access on public lands. And don't get me wrong, there's been some fake news out there saying I want to sell public lands, but that is completely false. And it's unfortunate that people feel the need to start those. And I'm going to be a protector of private property rights, always. So if you have any questions, please see me afterwards. But this is just an honor. Thank you.
All right, thank you. I'm asking for the honor of the good people of House District 63 to send me back for a third term. It's been an honor to serve my community in the legislature. I think I bring a distinct voice for young professionals trying to come home, young people, students, and I also, I should have mentioned, I'm an avid hunter and fisherman. I work on those issues in my day job. I was out fishing the Yellowstone River with my partner Alice on Saturday. And I'm looking forward to going deer hunting with my dad and brother and my nephews as soon as Election Day is behind us. The ability to serve our community in the legislature has been a great gift. I've learned a lot. I think campaigns are unfortunate because they force you into quick sound bites, and it starts to become apparent that we're applying simple answers to very complicated questions. That's not the way I've performed in the legislature as a policymaker. I'm probably not the most charismatic politician in the world, but I do love the policymaking process, and I'm passionate about it, and I've had success doing it. Last session, I introduced 16 pieces of legislation, and I passed 8 into law, and I think that's one of the best track records of anyone in the legislature as somebody in their mid-20s. So I've gotten things done for my district. I've worked with Republicans and Democrats. Minority leader put me in the very back, so I was surrounded by Republicans last session, and we had a great time back there. I always joke that I wasn't sure if I was the last Democrat or the first Republican. I like this job enough to run for a third term. Would be honored to have your vote. And as I always tell people on the doors, I hope I can earn your vote, but even if I can't, I still work for you, so be in touch.
Well, first and foremost, thanks everyone for being here, and thanks to the League for putting this event together. We don't get many chances to speak publicly, and it's really important to get these ideas going, and the questions were terrific. I'm running because it would be a privilege to serve the citizens of my community, and I'm running for specifics reasons to extend Medicaid, as we just spoke, to protect public lands and access to those lands, to ensure that there's equal pay for equal work in this state, to find solutions to affordable workforce housing and home ownership, advocating for Montana State University, including the renovation of Romney Hall. Go Cats. I'll support new sources of public revenue for property tax relief, as we spoke tonight, and infrastructure in Bozeman. I will protect our land, water, and critters, which are essential to our moral and ethical selves, but also because it's really important to our economy. I'm running because we're at a crossroads. Our beautiful community will need to make important and difficult decisions ahead. We need to ask tourists, probably, to pitch in to help us preserve the quality of life here. We need to address transportation and infrastructure. We need to identify ways to make Bozeman more livable. I'm endorsed by teachers, by the Gallatin Association of Realtors, Montana Conservation Voters, the AFL-CIO, and Planned Parenthood. Admittedly, an odd coupling, but I think it reflects the trust that I have across the political spectrum to be thoughtful, to listen, and then to fairly legislate. I envision a respectful, balanced, business smart state government. So much rides on this election. Please vote. To those in my district who have not voted, I ask for your support, and I look forward to working for my constituents in the 66th legislative session. Thank you.
I would just also like to say thank you to everyone for coming. I didn't realize there would be so many people here. And I was kind of reflecting when I was listening to everybody talk that I think that really speaks to the quality of person that's here in Bozeman. I think this is the magic stuff that makes us all want to live here. This is about community engagement, and I'm just feeling really proud right now. I've had a lot of support on both sides of the aisle, which I found truly remarkable when I came out and said that I was going to run. So I'm very honored by having both support from Democrats and Republicans. It's been phenomenal. And I also think that really says something about the people in Bozeman, that we're really a community of critical thinkers at the end of the day. Also, that's why you're all here. I currently serve on many committees and councils that have legislative activity, both on the national level and also on the state level. And so I'm looking forward to really taking that experience that I have, moving initiatives forward across party lines, and using those skills here in Bozeman. I truly believe that the people of Montana are really our greatest assets, and that our legislature is charged with making sensible investments both in our state and in our citizens. And that I believe also that the time is really right for a legislative body that is collaborative rather than divisive, that is compassionate rather than judgmental, and that's responsible to all rather than beholden to a few. And I am ready to take my experience and my optimism and work really, really hard to work for change alongside the people of Bozeman.
So yeah, I also want to thank everyone for coming out tonight. It is an honor and a privilege to be here, just talking with everybody. Why I'm running, well, I moved here in 2012. I came here for school, and then I just fell in love with the city and the state, and what I want to do is make my home a better place, you know, and I want to do that by serving you. Now, I've alluded to, you know, some of the things that I would like to pursue going forward. Among those, simplifying the tax code, you know, not just to put money back into people's hands, but to put power back in the hands of the citizen. I mean, that's ultimately what I want to do. You know, addressing some of the you know, mental health issues here in the state, making those services more available. As I mentioned, some criminal justice reform, addressing criminalization of drugs, rolling that back. Something else I would like to tackle, and this has been a difficult issue in the past, is amending Title 49, the Montana Human Rights Act, and expanding its non-discrimination protections to include gender identity and sexual orientation. So that just speaks to some of the decidedly, I don't want to say unpopular issues, but issues that are difficult to face, that others may not have the will to face, that I want to take on running. Thank you.
Thanks for coming out tonight. We as state legislators and our candidates don't often get a chance to talk to a group, so thank you for allowing us to do that. I would ask your support because I want to continue my history of volunteering. I think of this legislative activity as being a volunteer community activity, something that I've done a lot of in Bozeman, and I just wanted to expand it out to the state level, which is why I ran. I think of our job really as legislators as to balance the stepping into or staying out of the attraction to Montana that people have, the retention of keeping people here in Montana when they get here, and the protection of people if things don't happen to go right while they're here. That's a very difficult balance, but I think it's really what we are hired to do. And the reason that I want you to hire me is I think there are three things that I can bring. Number one, I'm quite good at avoiding the drift to the polar ends. We've got a lot of risk of drifting to polar ends, and I don't think we need that. Secondly, creative solutions, thinking out of the box to solve some of the problems that we have. And third, and probably most important, is the ability to develop relationships and to work with people to implement those creative solutions. If we're ever going to be successful in having an efficient legislature, we need to have that based on good relationships, as Zach was talking about, that he had in the back row there at the House. So thank you once again for coming. I would appreciate your support.